Welcome to Women Worth Knowing, the radio program and podcast hosted by Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn.
Hello, this is Cheryl Broderson. I'm in studio sans Robin because she's recovering. But I still want to say to you, there are so many Christian women with fascinating stories. And some are missionaries, some are musicians, some are reformers, there are authors, there's wives, there's mothers, there's single women. Just God uses so many women of all different backgrounds and all different nationalities in order to inspire us and give us examples of what it is to follow Jesus Christ into all his purposes and the amazing things that God does. I'm very excited to bring you part two of Dorothy Sayers. I was going to do one on Dorothy Sayers, then I found out a dear friend of mine and someone I totally admire, Dr. Amy Orr Ewing, did her doctoral thesis on Dorothy Sayers, and I said to myself, why reinvent the wheel? And when Amy came to California all the way from Oxford, England, I said, please, please, please come on the radio, or sorry, podcast, and speak with us about Amy Orr. Not Amy Orr Ewing, speak to us about Dorothy Sayers. That might be fixed. That might not be fixed. You might know I'm human. I don't know. But so we were at the scandalous part.
Yes.
Where, you know, it's so interesting to me because we were talking about her birth. And those of you out there who haven't listened to part one, please go back and listen to it. But we talked about how she was born into an Anglican family. Her father and her grandfather had both been, what we would call in America, pastors. And she was brilliant as a child, learning to read at the age of four, learning at least three different languages before she even turned 10. Just this amazing young woman who graduated early, went to Oxford, first cohort of women to graduate from Oxford. How she was a woman of strong principles. Her Christianity was very important to her. She was very strong in the faith. And she went from there to work at an advertising agency, rose very quickly in the ranks because of her brilliance, held on to her principles, began to write, was a successful writer, fell in love with a man who was also a writer, but was not willing to come to Christ, not willing to marry her, and wanted more of a sexual type of relationship, which she said no to because of her principles. But devastating news coming over from the United States, where he had moved, told her that he, in a letter, told her he had married. And after that, sunk into a depression where she had an affair with a totally unsuitable man and gave up all those, well, quite a few of her moral strengths.
Yeah. Well, so in her discouragement, kind of dated this very unsuitable man and did sleep with him and became pregnant and hid the pregnancy for the entire duration, carried on working in the advertising agency. People just thought she'd got enormously fat. You know, no one knew. Her parents didn't know. No one knew, not a single person. The one person she confided in towards the end of her pregnancy was her cousin, a young woman called Ivy, who sort of fostered children and this young woman agreed that she would take on and foster Sayers' child. So Sayers took the day off when she was going to have the baby and went away and gave birth and gave the child to her cousin and was back at work the next week. And no one ever knew. Parents never knew. Ivy was the only person who knew for a really long time.
Now, did she name him herself?
Yes, she did. Yeah. She named him, but he and she corresponded with him and he knew.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as a child, by the time he's about sort of 12, 13, I think he knew that she was the mother, but she corresponded with him the whole way through.
Mm.
There isn't a letter saying, I am your mother.
Right.
It just sort of, it kind of emerges.
No Luke Skywalker,
yeah, exactly.
Darth Vader moment, right. That's interesting.
Yeah. And then As she sort of she left the advertising agency because she became financially independent through the detective fiction, and then she began to write more theological plays. So she was given the opportunity to write a play for a play cycle that was happening in one of the cathedrals in Britain. And this became so popular that the British train company had to lay on more trains because thousands and thousands and thousands of people wanted to see this play. It's called A Zeal for Thy House. And she also then met her husband, the man who became to be, went on to become her husband. And I think she hoped that he would agree to adopt the child, that they could then kind of live as a family. But after they got married, that just did not work out. He was called Mac, and he turned out to be quite a sort of gruff, not terribly supportive husband. And so she was quite unhappy in her emotional life. So the fulfillment she experienced in life really happened through her writing and her art and her work, which obviously was absolutely prolific.
Right.
So after the success of the cathedral play cycle, the BBC approached her. And at this point, radio was a kind of new media. And they approached her and asked her, would she write a play cycle about Christ? And so she wrote The Man Born to be King, which was then broadcast on the radio, and millions of people listened to it. And it was controversial because...
Yes, I remember reading that, yes.
Yeah.
And wasn't it controversial? It's kind of like The Chosen, that is a popular series right now in the States. I don't know if it's in England.
Yes, it is.
Because it gave modern vernacular.
Language. Right. Yeah, it put modern language in the mouth of the characters, including the Lord. And so...
Which is like... Eugene Peterson's message.
Yeah, exactly. The Lord's Observance Society, they were called, were the kind of, you know, churchy campaigners who were absolutely incensed and created headlines that there was blasphemy, you know, on the radio at the BBC.
Which probably only made it more listened to.
Exactly. It had the opposite of, you know, their intended impact. As a result... of these plays, millions of people heard the words of Jesus in a format that was relatable to them. And the statistics actually show that church attendance went up in Britain in that era.
Wow.
So she had a huge impact, so much so that the head of the BBC, who was a Christian called Dr. Welch, wrote to the Regius Professor of Theology at Oxford, asking him to, with him together, the two of them, write to the Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop William Temple, who was, you know, a very strong, devout believer, godly man, and ask him to confer on Dorothy L. Sayers the Lambeth Doctorate. And the letter says that C.S. Lewis and Dorothy L. Sayers are the two people we have who can put forward a reasonably orthodox version of the Christian faith in a way that people will actually listen. So that gives you a sense of the vastness of the impact. I mean, this was huge, huge impact. So William Temple then did write to her, offering her the Lambeth Doctorate. And that would be a very, very high honour. It might be like a sort of, I don't know, presidential medal or something here. Like a very, very prestigious award. And she wrote back, turning it down. And she gave the reason that she didn't want to be a sort of official representative of Christianity, and she would hate for the first woman DD to basically let the church down or cause a scandal. So she didn't confess to anything specific.
But she alluded.
But it seems almost certain that she feared that the news of, you know, her pregnancy and, you know, the birth of her child outside of marriage would come out and bring the Lord's name into disrepute.
Which in that time, it would have.
It would have, And so, would have devastated her parents and, you know,
You see how many sacrifices she had to make. You know, so many women who do these great things from the Lord, they're paying a high price for it.
Yeah. And you know, I think also that sense that the Lord uses us with all our imperfections.
Yes.
And to think that the foremost female communicator of the Christian faith in Britain, probably in the, you know, certainly in the mid part of the 20th century, seen alongside C.S. Lewis as the key voice, that was her story, I think is amazing. It actually sort of speaks of the gospel and the redemption the gospel can bring. But it wasn't able to be publicly known at that point.
Which is so tragic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I grew up at Calvary Chapel with every other week it was a testimony of somebody. And we embraced people's weaknesses, knowing that the Lord could be their strength. So it is tragic. I wanted to ask about you know, the unhappiness, kind of touch on that in her marriage, because they were going to, as you said, she had hoped to bring her son.
Yeah.
Was her son's name?
John Anthony.
She had hoped to bring him into the home.
Yeah.
And she did take him out of the place he was living, right?
Yeah. So she did have extended visits with him, and she paid for his education, and he did come and stay, but he didn't live with them. So he was at school, and it never worked out with her husband that he could actually live with them as a family, as their adopted child. And obviously, without sort of formally adopting him, it would have seemed a bit strange to have her cousin's foster child visit too often.
That's true.
So there was kind of tension over that. Although obviously she completely financially supported him and his education and all of that.
So I read one review of this woman who said, or I'm sorry, it was a man who had gone to hear her speak, and that he said she was so plain looking, but when she began to speak, it was riveting.
Mm.
So she did begin to speak. What was the kind of the main topics that when she did speak, what would she talk about?
So after the Man Born to Be King play cycle, she was then invited to sort of offer short articles, which were kind of like essays for various publications. And they were around really interesting themes about what it would look like to rebuild a Christian nation after the war. She wrote about vocation. She wrote three brilliant essays about work and what work is.
Tim Keller loved those.
Yes, and they are really amazing.
They are, because
one of them is called Why Work, the most famous one, and then was one called Christian Vocation. And yeah, she then began to be asked to do kind of like broadcast talks almost on the radio, and she would make the case for the kind of moral argument for God being the foundation of Western civilization and why we resist fascism and totalitarianism, which is very current in her age. She had this fascinating image of our civilization, Western civilization, being like a necklace with the beads being strung together and holding together with coherence, you know, with democracy and freedom, but the string running through the necklace is actually Christ and his incarnation. And you can snip the string and you can hope the necklace will hold together, but you actually don't have any reason to believe it will if you cut that string. And that's a really, really powerful image. So she's kind of making a case for the Christian faith being you know, the underpinning of culture. She wrote a lot about the Trinity as well.
Yes.
And she wrote about Christian aesthetics. So she wrote about the idea that beauty in any form actually points us towards God and not away from him. So and gave talks about these things all over the place. And as you mentioned, she was a very frumpy woman. She was quite a large woman. She didn't dress well. She didn't have a sort of attractive appearance, but her speaking was utterly compelling. Yeah.
I love that about her too.
In fact, C.S. Lewis wrote the eulogy for her funeral, and it was called "That Ogreish Lady."
Thank you, C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine that's the epitaph on your tomb.
Right. And what happened to the Irish slogan "Never speak ill of the dead"?
Yeah, come on, exactly. But he kind of meant it as a compliment. Yes. He had this sort of feistiness and this fire in her that enabled her to make a way where no other women had really gone before. And
we mentioned that she wasn't part of the Inklings, but she was kind of an honourable Inkling.
She was, yeah. So the Inklings are a group of people he met in the Eagle and Child pub in Oxford regularly to talk, and J.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis obviously were the key members of that, but others as well. And she corresponded with Lewis. She didn't live in Oxford, so that would have affected it. And, you know, out of the 50,000 letters, a good number of them talk about the bomb damage to the country and the absolute nightmare of the train system and the constant delays.
Oh, right. So she couldn't make it to Oxford.
She couldn't sort of zip up to Oxford for a meeting of the Inklings, really, very easily. So, yeah, she corresponded with Charles Williams, who gave her all sorts of ideas and opportunities, and first introduced her to the poet Dante.
Okay.
Through,
yes.
Yeah, the figure of Beatrice, mm-hmm. Which he'd written. And so her intellectual kind of growth as a Christian writer really happened through letters and correspondence rather than through informal conversation. And it's interesting as a woman that there's a very sort of tight set of men. She's kind of on the outside of it a little bit, but she's also just forging this trail, this path.
Now, she also formed her own group. I can't remember the name of it, but it was with other women that were intellectuals where they would read their transcripts,
yes.
So to speak, to each other and take criticism and improvements.
Yes, so she did that with the detective fiction as well, actually. So and then there were a group of authors as well who agreed that they were going to write a series of books that The Mind of the Maker was part of that series too. So she was part of different cohorts, but she was also quite a loner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was not an emotive person at all. In fact, she even talked about, she had this phrase, the passionate intellect, and she talked about how she couldn't come to God on the basis of feelings, but it was the intellectual pattern of the Christian faith that attracted her.
Its I think she mentions that in the Diminished Church.
Yeah, yeah, that's a collection of her writings that, yeah.
Yeah, because she talks about that. And yet, in that particular book, she writes with such passion, again, about the incarnation, about the doctrine.
Yes.
You know, about how doctrine is the most exciting.
Yeah.
And her work, for lack of a better word, and in fact, I found Letters to a Diminished Church and then Are Women Human even more, what do I want to say, enthralling. Yes. In the Peter Wimsey novel.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's and it's the format is wonderful because it's short,
right.
Concise. It's a thought that is developed over a few pages brilliantly, but you don't have to read the whole book.
No.
You know?
Yes.
So she does that really well. You know, there's tremendous passion there, but what I mean is she wasn't in the least bit sentimental.
Right.
And
but
she was
in her writing. It was like all that passion was almost reserved for her writing.
Kind of channeled, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, though it wasn't, it was inside.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, again, you know, very British.
No maybe,
offense,
yeah.
That's only half of you. But it's very British to kind of be, you know, unemotive on the outside.
Yeah.
But those passions needed an outlet.
Yes.
And they were definitely in her writing.
Absolutely, yeah. And the essays obviously became bestsellers as well. She had a collection called Creed or Chaos. And the sort of beating heart of that is this idea that the church has made Christ and Christianity boring. And she said that's the most unbelievable feat, because the story of the incarnation is the greatest drama to have ever staggered the imagination of humanity. And that if it hadn't actually been true, it would have been an idea created by the greatest author or playwright, you know. So she has this phrase, the dogma is the drama. Like, the drama at the heart of the Christian faith is the truth of, you know, God incarnate, dying and rising and defeating evil and sin. And, you know, she's absolutely scathing about the way the kind of clergy of the era have, she talks about how they've taken the Lion of Judah and pared his claws and made him a petting cat fit for pale curates and pious old ladies, you know, and actually Jesus is this kind of roaring lion.
So, yes, yeah. She also had a phrase like he was anything but boring.
Exactly, yeah.
Anything but boring. And that's, again, that you sense in that writing, it's almost tumultuous. I mean, you can't read it and not be moved.
Yes. And also you've got to remember she's living through the Second World War, through the bombing, the Blitz, you know, bombs falling near you the whole time, losing people close to you, the threat of Nazi invasion hanging over your head, the threat of coming under totalitarianism, the reality of the culture of death, of fascism, just, you know, at the door. So the urgency of the struggle between good and evil is really there, I think. And that's partly because it's there in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, you know, the response to that was just to keep calm and carry on, just live and don't think about it. But I think what Sayers does so brilliantly is apply the truth of the gospel to that current, you know, cultural context that she found herself in. It's very relevant to us today as well.
It is so relevant to us today. And again, especially the part of, you know, creating an anemic Jesus.
Yeah.
That is, you know, this pacifist.
Yes.
Who can, you know, because he calmed the sea, not realizing, no, he's the conquering king.
Yeah.
Who has risen from the dead. Yeah.
And she was also taking on the atheists of her generation as well, and what was called the demythologizers. So the liberals who were trying to cut any kind of miraculous or divine claims of Jesus from the Bible. So,
and they were in the church.
Oh, yeah.
the worst was in
the church.
That's right.
Exactly. And so as a laywoman, as not a professional Christian, you know, as someone who's a writer.
And a woman.
She's
right.
Taking them on and basically saying, how dare you? How dare you do this to Jesus? And no wonder the pews are empty. And showing that, you know, even a sort of simple portrait of the true Christ draws people. You know, when the Son of Man is lifted up, he'll draw people to himself. And that is just evidenced in Sayers' work in the most beautiful way, from the thousands flocking to the cathedrals to see the plays, from the millions listening to the radio plays, The Man Born to Be King, you know, from people buying her essays in their millions as well. Yeah.
Presenting a compelling Jesus, which he is.
The true Jesus, yeah.
Right, which, you know, I've always, you know, had that conviction, show the true Jesus.
Yeah, exactly.
And people will be, as you said, drawn to the true, exciting Jesus who you can't put in any political category or in any political party.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he defies those, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're coming to the close of part two, but we still have quite a bit because we want to talk about her work with Dante, which was amazing, and talk a little bit about what Dante is for those, because a lot of that is lost to us today.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about Dante in part three. I'm sorry to do this to you, but you have to do part three. We'll talk about Dante. We'll talk about her death, you know, and then the legacy that she left. And maybe I have some questions also about, you know, the sun and how all that ended up. So we'll talk about that in part three. Also, Amy herself, Dr. Amy Orr Ewing, is an authoress, and we want to talk in part three about some of the books that she has written that you'll want to read too. So all that coming up in part three. Don't forget to come back next week.
Thank you for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn. For more information on Cheryl, visit CherylBroderson.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. For more information on Robin, visit RobinGunn.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. Join us each week for a lively conversation as we explore the lives of well-known and not-so-well-known historical and contemporary Christian women. If you think there is a woman worth knowing, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at WWK@cccm.com. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Make sure you rate us on your podcast app, subscribe, and share it with a friend. Thank you again for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn. Women Worth Knowing is a production of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa.